The New York Times publishes tranches of Donald Trump's long-concealed tax returns, providing another significant twist in an already unprecedented presidential election year. Lessons from Leuven. We'll hear from the mayor of the Belgian city on its designation as Europe's City of Innovation for 2020. And is British Broadcasting about to welcome a new rolling news service that's been characterised as the UK's answer to Fox News? Monocle's editors and correspondents take on those stories today, here on the late edition on Monocle 24. Hello there and a very warm welcome to you to the late edition here on Monocle 24. It is Monday, the 28th of September, and I'm Tomos Lewis here in Toronto. And joining us today from London are Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, and Monocle 24's Marcus Hippie. Andrew, Marcus, thank you both very much for being with us on the programme today. Andrew, we are at the start of another week. How are things looking there from your vantage point in London?
There's two stories, as always. There's the personal story, which is actually just fine, thank you. But then there's the kind of political story, which is unfolding in this country. And you really do have to kind of ration yourself looking at any headlines at the moment here in the UK, because it feels even the newspapers don't know what angle to take on what's happening with COVID in this country. Many papers on the right claiming that Boris Johnson is losing grip, has lost control of the argument. Papers on the left feel that it's wrong for students to have gone back to university, that there should be more lockdown measures put in place now to protect the National Health Service. But in fact, I find that most of the papers you look at are trying to run both angles of the story because they don't know which way that their readership is going. So if you have an older readership, you're keen to protect their interests, for example, but you also know that exactly the same readers are often the ones which are a little bit more gung-ho and libertarian and feel that we shouldn't be placed under too many government restrictions. So it's fascinating to watch, but just a bit dull to experience.
And Marcus, the same question to you. How's the week shaping up for you there in London as well?
Well, the week is shaping up quite nicely. I have to refer to what Andrew said about the rather confusing and a bit depressing news from the UK. I made the decision of leaving the country for a week, so I'm flying to Finland on Wednesday. Not to say that the situation would not be getting a bit confused over there as well. In Finland, there's a fair bit of disagreement now about the government's COVID-19 policy, how to fight the pandemic. For months, it seemed that everyone was thinking that Sanna Marin was doing a really good job when she was keeping the borders closed, to pretty strictly keep them closed and at the same time protecting the nation. And it did seem to work during the first wave. The number of COVID-19 cases wasn't that bad. But now the numbers are increasing again and basically business leaders are trying to call the government to ease the restrictions, what's happening at the border. We know that tourism in the Finnish Lapland is going to suffer massively now when tourists from abroad can't go there to meet Santa Claus, for example. And at the same time, we're hearing from the state national carrier, Finnair, for example, they're saying that their financial situation is looking really dire because there are not that many places where they can fly at the moment.
Well, the news might be downbeat in many parts of the world, but it is always an upbeat treat to have you both with us on the programme today. Andrew, Marcus, thanks very much for being with us. Well, let's begin in the United States, where President Donald Trump paid just $750 US in federal income tax in 2016. That's one of the key takeaways amid revelations made by the New York Times yesterday. The claims have upended once again a presidential campaign already being held in unprecedented circumstances and were published just 2 days before the first televised presidential debate between President Trump and his challenger Joe Biden, which takes place in Cleveland, Ohio tomorrow night. Donald Trump has long tried to keep his tax returns secret, a break with convention of past US presidents. And in the minds of many, particularly those of the president's opponents, the New York Times' revelations will explain why. Well, on today's edition of The Globalist, here on Monocle 24, Brian Klass, a columnist for the Washington Post newspaper and an associate professor in global politics at University College London, explained how the claims might now play out for President Trump's re-election campaign.
One is that the time is running out for him to reset the narrative of the race, which he's losing right now. And the more that the focus is on bad news for Trump, which this clearly is, the harder it is for him to turn around the election. But beyond that, you also have the question of faltering support among soft supporters of Donald Trump, the non-diehards. And they've been sold this image of Donald Trump that's simply not true. What effectively has happened is he got genuine large amounts of income from The Apprentice. So he got over $400 million in assets from being The Apprentice host, a fake businessman on TV, that he then invested in real businesses, which he lost, and then avoided paying tax because of those losses. That is a very different picture from what Donald Trump sold to the American public when he ran in 2016 and throughout his presidency as somebody who turned, you know, everything into gold. And in fact, he turned gold into dust that he then used the dust to write off and avoid taxes that other hardworking Americans are paying. So politically, it's a very, very bad story for him.
Brian Klass of University College London there, speaking to us on The Globalist today. Andrew, it struck me listening to Brian there and looking at commentary of Donald Trump's tax returns over the years. They've been a source of speculation and scrutiny for some time. We haven't, though, quite seen the kind of reporting that suggests they and the fact that Donald Trump was keeping them hidden specifically were a concrete issue, if you like, for voters in the way, for example, his alleged behaviour towards women has been over the years for many voters in the United States. Do you think President Trump can dismiss these now as fake news, as he has already done? Or do these claims reveal someone, as Brian suggested there, quite different to the kind of person Donald Trump's presented himself as to his supporters so far?
Well, I think Brian was correct to identify two tiers of voters, the hard voters, the hard supporters of Donald Trump, and the soft supporters. I think on the hard side, yes, he can dismiss them. And he's already done it. He's already said it's fake news. There's no truth in this. I pay a huge amount of taxes. There's nothing in here that's correct. Every fact is false. And I think for his hardline supporters, they'll go along with him. And even if they don't go along with him, you must remember there are many on the right, there are very many strong libertarian Americans who don't believe you should pay your taxes anyway. They don't like the state being involved with you. So if they think that somebody has managed to dodge paying taxes or avoid, let's say, paying taxes, they won't care. They will see that actually as a bit of a badge of honor. Here's a guy who outwitted the system. So I think for those people, it doesn't matter. The interesting thing is for this softer voter, will they think actually Donald Trump, you know, presented himself as a very successful business person who had generated vast sums of money for all of his businesses, you know, a clever, shrewd guy who was the right person to be the custodian of the economy? And will they, when they look at him now, begin to think, hold on, this doesn't add up. Here's a guy who, in fact, was running up huge debts, who's personally responsible for massive amounts, hundreds of millions of dollars of debts that are going to become due very soon. So again, you see why he might want to stay president, because which bank would want to chase a sitting president to pay off his debts? So it's a fascinating moment. And I think that for some of those people, of course, that's the interesting bit. Will they shy away from a man now who seems to be a little bit suspect on the business front and who also, it turns out, claimed a massive $70,000 in hairstyling tax deductions alone for his television appearances?
Well, it is the most iconic hairdo out there, arguably, Andrew, so perhaps for some it's money well spent. But Marcus, to turn to you and to put you on the spot slightly, these revelations were made just days before the first televised presidential debate. To put you in the hot seat, if you were moderating the debate tomorrow night, how deeply would you go into these revelations now? Should they be weighted more, do you think, than, say, President Trump's handling of the coronavirus outbreaks in the US or the economic picture on his watch, for example?
Well, the first reaction of mine when I read the news of how much Donald Trump had been paying income tax was that I probably spent more money at the Monaco Cafe in the financial year 2016-17 than Donald Trump. But as Andrew just pointed out, it's actually, many people may just think that he's been very clever when he's escaping having to pay taxes, and that in a way makes him a good businessman. But to your question whether we should be paying more attention to how he's been dealing with COVID-19 outbreak or how the US economy is doing, I think those probably are more important things now for the wider audience. You know, we know that there's been something a bit dodgy going on with Donald Trump's taxes, considering that he's been so reluctant to release that information. And looking ahead to the 4 years more of this, I think we should really talk about how he's been dealing with the US economy, for example, how he's been dealing with Washington's relationship with many other capitals around the world, how the world has got so much tenser as a place. And also, obviously, we can't escape the way he's been handling COVID-19 and, you know, what he's done and what he hasn't done, how much he's known about how dangerous the virus is already during the first weeks or months of the outbreak and so forth. So looking at the big picture, I think his taxes are something we can always return to later on. And we seem to know that Donald Trump is not quite the successful businessman some people thought he was. But looking at the real challenges the US is facing at the moment, I think the focus should indeed be in the economy and COVID-19.
Well, we will have full coverage for you of tomorrow night's presidential debate in Cleveland, Ohio, on Wednesday here on Monocle 24. Well, next here on The Late Edition, the Belgian city of Leuven has been awarded 2020's European Capital of Innovation. It's a €1 million prize that recognises the changes made by the city to improve the lives of its residents. Its mayor is Mohamed Ridouani, and he said that he sees the city now as a model that could offer a template to other urban centres in Europe.
When we announced this huge new mobility plan where we pushed out the cars out of our city centre, you know how difficult that is to change behaviour. You know, there was a big buy-in from the citizens. And along the way, they saw that the changes were good for them, that they were healthier by taking the bicycle, that their children went out and in a comfortable public space, in a safe public space. So people see the good things of the change, but because there is this connectedness, we try to connect leadership in the city around common ambitions and work on them. I believe that's the way how you make buy-in. And I think that's very relevant today in a Europe that seems a bit shattered, where people don't believe anymore in democracy. I think we need to restore it in that sense.
Mohamed Ridouani, the mayor of the Belgian city of Leuven, speaking to us on The Globalist this morning. Andrew, as the host of The Urbanist here on Monocle 24, what have been some of the measures that the city of Leuven has put in place that has been rewarded for here by the EU? What caught your eye particularly from what they've done there?
Well, first of all, I would say that the EU, which is behind this award, should get someone better at writing their press releases, because when you try and wade through the speak that is put into these press releases, it's actually quite hard to decipher exactly what they have done. They talk about innovation concepts, processes and government models, creating a framework that brings ideas to life. It's very difficult to know what the precise things are. And there we heard the mayor talking about some very practical things about mobility, getting more people to use bicycles. And I don't want to detract from his award, but let's just see some of the things that he's got on his side. This is a city of 100,000 people. The neighbourhood where I live in here in London, Camden, the little borough of Camden, has 260,000 people in it. So we're talking about a very small place, which is actually quite easy to manoeuvre. For another advantage he has, it's home to one of the most famous innovative universities in Europe, KU Leuven. And the whole city, or the whole town rather, let's call it a town, is embedded in this world of academia, of science, of testing, although they are home to the world's largest brewery as well, we should point out, so they can celebrate at the end of the day. But so here you have a lot of innovative, often young people in a small city where it's not complicated to get around anyway, and they're Flemish. And we're talking about people who are, you know, like their Dutch neighbours, born on a bicycle. So they've got lots of things going for them. So let's not take away from it. But what you see here is the advantage of having a student population, of having seats of academia within your town. And then it joins up with what government's doing, because then you have, you know, you have a very, very receptive audience. And I don't think, you know, a city like London should think, oh my God, we didn't win. But this is really a mark of the kinds of people that live within your city walls.
And Marcus, the idea of being a smaller urban centre, is that an advantage, do you think, as Andrew mentioned there, when you can be more novel, a bit bolder perhaps, with some of the ideas and the policies you aim to put through in that urban centre? Does being small give you an unfair advantage, if I can put it that way, do you think?
I don't know if it's a major advantage, but I would imagine it does benefit you a little bit if you're a smaller operator. It may make the whole thing a bit more flexible, I would imagine. When I was listening to what we heard from the mayor of Leuven and, you know, what Andrew just said, I was thinking about my own former home city of Helsinki, which is actually surprisingly big. I didn't realize it's actually 5-6 times bigger. And even in Helsinki, you know, compared to places like London, I'm seeing, you know, projects where they try to get local people involved, and that does work really well. It's something I wouldn't necessarily imagine taking place in bigger places. You know, if I'm thinking about what Helsinki has been doing recently, one of the examples that comes to mind is that maybe 2 years ago, they had some spare money in the budget and they organized a vote asking from people how they would like that money to be spent, into what kind of projects to benefit local communities and make good things happen. And then they shortlisted 5 top suggestions, and I found myself vote for something as well. And I was very delighted by that. And that was one of these things Mayor of Leuven mentioned as well, to make people feel like they are heard, to support that democratic process. And I think that is something that smaller cities and smaller towns can succeed better in. You know, I live in London, I've been living in London for years, and do I feel like my local city hall or town hall is listening to what I say? I don't really feel like my voice is heard the same way it was when I was living in Helsinki, for example. And looking at Leuven being even a small place, I would imagine that it makes things a bit easier to make people feel like they actually belong somewhere, that they are rooted somewhere, and they do have some influence over where they live.
Well, finally here on the late edition, let's turn to the media, where in the UK, one of the BBC's most recognisable political interviewers has said that he's leaving the corporation to become chairman of a new TV news channel in the UK, GB News, which many commentators have suggested will mark the arrival of a more opinion-led rolling news station, like in the US, to the United Kingdom. Well, our culture editor, Chiara Ramella, had more on Andrew Neil's departure from the BBC for us on The Briefing today.
He's looking to launch GB News. It's going to be right-leaning and it's going to be modelled, or at least reminiscent to many, of the kind of Fox News beat. And I think what's interesting about this is that he says that this is going to serve that audience that doesn't feel met by the kind of output that the BBC is putting out. It's going to have to be impartial to the Ofcom standards, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to have continuous kind of balance between the opinions that it shows. It just needs to show alternating viewpoints. What's interesting, I think, is that as an opinion-based channel going to work better than a news rolling channel? We seem to see that opinion-based channels do have very high ratings, and opinion-based coverage is cheaper to produce than rolling news. So whether this is a smart business investment and if it's going to actually get the traction that it wants, we'll have to wait and see.
Chiara Ramella, Monocle's culture editor there, speaking to us a little earlier today. Andrew, listening to your Chiara there, what do you make of the arrival of something like GB News to the British media landscape?
Well, I think it's fascinating, and I don't see why it should fail. Many people are saying, look, you know, the British don't like this kind of, you know, TV. They like their TV to be much more balanced, a little bit more kind of like the BBC, and anybody who moves into this sector is going to have to reflect those same ideals. But it's just not true. If you think about when people pick up their daily newspaper, people are tribal, they read columnists who are outspoken, and that's a little bit of what's going to be brought to this TV channel. So whether you're a supporter or not, I don't see why the format is any problem. It's backed by Discovery. Some $65 million supposedly has already been put up to get the channel going. He's going to be the chair and a presenter on this channel. But I guess the thing that everyone's intrigued to know whether is true or not is, you know, we hear endless talk about there being a culture war, which, you know, perhaps is more a real thing in the US, but we hear it being played out in the newspapers here and on the airwaves. I don't know whether that's true, but there's a feeling that Andrew Neil was pushed out of the BBC because his views were a little bit too on the right and that people didn't understand what he brought to the BBC. So he's leaving, and it happens at a time when the government is looking to make some major appointments here to run Ofcom, which is the body that oversees broadcasting, to make some appointments to the BBC, and is advertising for those positions. And at the weekend, there were rumours that 2 people, again, on the right, might be the preferred candidates for those positions. So you hear all this talk, and you realise for the BBC it's a dangerous moment, what he's doing, because not that it's going to be a huge challenge to their audiences, but they've got to be seen to be reflective of all sorts of opinions. And, you know, most media organizations end up being pretty liberal, pretty central, trying to campaign for freedom of expression, etc. But they have to somehow incorporate more people on the right unless they want to have a huge battle with the government. So I'm not an endless fan of Andrew Neil, but he is a very good interviewer, and you know, he is definitely serving a market. And if it shakes up the media landscape, then good luck to him.
And Marcus, this idea that we heard from Chiara there about, you know, opinion-led news channels being cheaper to produce, that there's less burden than doing a sort of more traditional sort of rolling news channel. What do you make of this blurring of the lines between opinion and news? Does that worry you? Is there a space in the market there for that, do you think, in the UK?
I think it's going to be very interesting to see how this is going to work out, how they draw the line, how they specify what is going to be opinion and what is actual reporting and what is actual news. You know, looking at my own media consumption, I love columnists, for example. I love people who commentators who have opinions. I love a good column that teases and provokes and causes some kind of an emotional reaction. And I think that's something that people often want. They want to, you know, have someone with strong opinions to say something. And maybe that is something that has been gradually kind of eroding people's belief and trust in media when they can't actually understand the difference between what is opinion and what is actual journalism, reporting, news coverage. And I think, first of all, I think media outlets should make that division clear. But I think it's also down to the audience members to actually have the skills of, you know, what they are reading, what they are watching, what is it actually, you know, should you have some criticism over what you are reading, you know, where does this information come from, how reliable is it, and so forth. And I think it's down to education partly. I think, you know, if I look at what's been happening in the US, what's been happening in the UK, and what's happening in my home country of Finland, I often feel like in Finland, people are better when it comes to following the media. They're better in understanding and having a certain amount of criticism because I think it's down to education. They've been taught that at school, that you shouldn't believe everything you read in social media or everything you read online or even everything you read or see on television nowadays.
Well, Marcus Hippie and Andrew Tuck, that's all I'm afraid to say we have time for today's edition of The Late Edition. A big thank you to the two of you for being with us today. Our studio manager in London today was David Stevens. A big thanks to him, as always, too. The Late Edition returns at the same time tomorrow, but do stay with us here at Monocle 24 for more news, more discussion, and much more too. I'm Thomas Lewis here in Toronto. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.